Radio Players presents Orson Welles' version of Bram Stoker's great novel, Dracula.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Arthur Seward. I am here tonight to bear witness to the truth of certain events which you may find it hard to believe, but I ask you to believe them. I have here certain documents, telegrams, clippings from the press of the day, memoranda and letters in various hands. All needless matters have been eliminated. Though the history is almost at variance with the possibilities of contemporary belief, they stand forth as simple fact. I present you first with excerpts from the private journal of Jonathan Harker.
I, Jonathan Harker, lawyer's clerk, articles to Peter Hawkins, Esquire of Exeter, England, am writing this journal in the hope that if misfortune overtakes me, it may one day come to the eyes of those who love me. I set out from London on the last day of April to visit one of our clients in Eastern Europe. On May the 3rd, I arrived in Budapest and came after nightfall to Klausenburg on the border of Transylvania. At Bistritz, there was a letter of welcome for me from our client, informing me that his carriage would await me at the Borgo Pass. It was signed, Dracula.
Bukovina! Coach for Bukovina!
The road was rough, but still we seemed to fly over it with feverish haste. When it grew dark, there seemed to be some excitement among the passengers. They kept speaking to the driver and looking at me and urging him on with the greatest speed. The crazy coach rocks from its great leather springs. The mountains seemed to come near to us on either side. Coachman! Coachman, what is it? Where are we?
You are nearing your destination, young heir. This is the Borgo Pass.
There are black, rolling clouds overhead. In the air, the heavy, oppressive sense of thunder. Now we go through the pass.
The young heir is not expected after all.
You are early tonight, my friend.
A calèche with four horses had drawn up beside us.
Let me help you, sir.
The coachman smiled. The lamplight fell on a hard-looking mouth with berry-red lips and sharp-looking teeth, white as ivory. We began to move. I looked back. The coach with its load of passengers had vanished from sight. We swept into the darkness of the pass. I struck a match. It was within a few minutes of midnight. Then a dog began to howl somewhere far down the road. The wind was rising, moaning and whistling through the rocks, and the branches of the trees crashed together as we swept along. They grew colder and colder still, and fine, powdery snow began to fall. The baying of wolves sounded nearer and nearer, as if they were closing around us from every side. We kept on ascending, always ascending. The howling of wolves was growing less. Presently, it ceased altogether, and then just the moon broke through the black clouds, and by its light, I saw around us a ring of wolves running alongside the carriage in silence, with white teeth and lolling red tongues, long sinewy limbs and shaggy hair.
Welcome to my house.
I must have fallen asleep. The carriage had pulled up in the courtyard of a vast ruined castle. The coachman was nowhere to be seen.
Welcome to my house. Come freely, go safely, and leave something of the happiness you bring.
Count Dracula?
I am Dracula.
The face is strong. Very strong, aquiline. The mouth, so far as I could see it, was fixed and rather cruel looking, peculiarly sharp white teeth.
You hear them, Mr. Harker?
The wolves?
The children of the night. As you say, Mr. Harker, the wolves. Listen. Come now. There are many things you must tell me tomorrow. Of England, and of the estate there you have purchased for me.
Yes.
The estate is called Carfax, I believe.
Yes, that's so.
But now, I will detain you no longer. You will find your room in readiness, and I advise you not to leave it during the night.
This castle is on the very edge of a terrible precipice. A stone falling from the window would fall 1,000 feet without touching anything. I explored. There are doors, doors, doors everywhere. All of them locked. The door to the great hall, the door to the courtyard, every door in this castle is closed, bolted against me. Castle Dracula is a prison, and I am a prisoner. The next night, I could not sleep. So after a few hours, I got up and, lighting my candle, I placed my shaving mirror on the dressing table and was just beginning to shave.
You feel rested, Mr. Harker?
I had not seen him, although the reflection of the glass covered the whole room behind me. I turned to the glass again. Count Dracula was close to me, and I could see him over my shoulder, but there was no reflection of him in the mirror. It was blank. I started and cut myself on the side of the throat. The blood was trickling down my neck. My mirror!
The blood! The blood! Wipe the blood from your face, Mr. Harker, and take care how you cut yourself. It is more dangerous than you think in this country.
When I awoke, I found most of my things were gone. My passport, my notes, my letter of credit. I could find no trace of them anywhere. My door was locked from the outside. June 20th. There's work of some kind going on in the castle. Now and then I hear the faraway muffled sound of mattock and spade, and last night, the second of three dated letters which Dracula made me write. The second of that series, which was to blot out the very traces of my existence from the earth, went forth! Count Dracula!
Yes, my young friend.
Well, what of me? When am I free? When can I leave this place?
Free? Mr. Harker, you are always free. You want to leave? Would you like to leave tonight?
Yes! Yes, in God's name!
My dear young friend, not an hour shall you wait in my house against your will. Come, follow me. Your door seems to be bolted. How strange, your door is locked.
In God's name, open it!
As you will, Mr. Harker. You English have a proverb which is very close to my heart. Welcome the coming. Speed, departing guests. Good night, Mr. Harker.
Shut the door! Shut the door! Shut the door! Shut the door!
The door is shut, Mr. Harker. I take it, you will remain.
Morning, June the 30th. These may be the last words I ever write in this diary. God preserve my sanity. I have never seen Count Dracula by day. At sunrise, at the first cockcrow, he is gone. I don't understand these things. I only know that the wolves are baying, and that he is a man with hair on the palms of his hands, with sharp teeth and no blood in his face. He casts no shadow. He cannot be seen in the glass, and he moves like a bat across the sheer face of the castle walls. He eats no food and is mortally afraid of the crucifix. As I write this, I hear in the courtyard the rolling of heavy wheels and cracking of whips. And there is in the passageway up below a pound of heavy boxes being set down. Boxes shaped like coffins, and I know what they hold. The boxes are filled with holy earth and the chapel beneath the castle. The last box being nailed down. Now I hear the heavy feet tramping again. Door is shut, and the chains rattle. In the courtyard and down the rocky way, the roll of heavy wheels, the cracks of whips. Help. Help! Help! The wagons have gone. I'm alone in the castle. I'm alone in the castle! I'm alone in the castle! I'm alone! I'm alone! I'm alone!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Dr. Seward. Mr. Harker's journal terminates at this point. I now present into evidence a clipping dated August of that year from the Yorkshire Telegraph from my correspondence in Whitby. One of the greatest and sudden of storms on record was experienced here today. The weather has been somewhat sultry, but Saturday evening was fine. The band was playing, the piers were crowded with holidaymakers. The winds went away entirely in the evening, and there was a dead calm. There were but few lights at sea. The only sail noticeable was a foreign schooner. Under full canvas, they were seemingly going westward. A little after midnight came a strange sound from over the sea, and high overhead the air began to carry a strange, faint, hollow booming. Then without warning, the tempest broke, and there, with all sails set, was the foreign schooner, rushing with terrific speed toward the shore. A searchlight was turned on her, and there, lashed to the helm, was a corpse with drooping head which swayed horribly to and fro at each motion of the ship. A moment later, she crashed. Then a strange thing was seen. At the very instant she touched, a huge dog sprang up on deck from below, and running forward, jumped from the bow onto the sand, and making straight up the east cliff toward the graveyard, vanished into the night. The Coast Guard going abroad at dawn found the dead man fastened to a spoke of the wheel. Tightly clutched in one hand was a crucifix. The man must have been dead for quite 2 days. In the pocket of the dead man's coat was found a bottle, carefully corked, containing a roll of paper. This proved to be an addendum to the ship's log. There was found on board only a small amount of cargo, and that of a most unusual nature. Apparently, the ship carried nothing but earth, common earth, packed away in wooden boxes, shaped much like coffins.
Log of the Demeter, Russian flag, Black Sea to Whitby, July 7th, finished taking in cargo. A queer cargo, boxes of earth. At noon, set sail, east wind fresh. Crew, four hands, two mates cooked, and myself captain. July 11th, entered Bosporus. At dark, passed through Dardanelles. Mate reported in morning that one of crew, Fyodin, was missing.
Took larboard watch, 8 bells last night. He was relieved by Delisian, who never came to his bunk. There is something aboard this ship. Oh, don't laugh, captain. In the rain last night.
Aww.
A tall, thin man go up the companionway and along the deck forward and disappear. When I go to the bow, no one, and the hatchways were all closed.
July 22nd. Rough weather last 3 days. All hands busy with sails. No time to be frightened. Past Gibraltar and other straits. All well. July 24th. Last night. Another hand was lost. Disappeared.
Like Talisian, he came off his watch at midnight and we never see him again. You, take your watch now.
I don't take watch alone no more.
Nor will I.
No more. Double watch.
Double watch.
July 29th. At single watch tonight, as crew too tired to double. When morning came...
Oi! Oi, Balky, below! Balky, where are the guns?
Balky gone, like all the others.
Like all the others?
The mate and I have agreed to go on henceforth. July 30th, last night. We are nearing England. Weather fine, all sails set.
Captain! Captain! The men on watch are missing! More missing!
Now, only self and mate and one hand left to work ship. August 3rd, 2 days of fog and not a sail sighted. At midnight, I went to relieve the man at wheel, and when I got to it, I found no one there.
It's here. I know it now. I saw it. Like a man, taller and thin, ghastly pale. It was in the bows and looking out. I gave it my knife, but the knife went right through it, empty as the air.
What are you talking about?
It's here, and I'll find it. It's in the hold. It's in one of these boxes of earth. I'll unscrew them one by one and see, and see.
He is mad. Stark raving mad. It's no use my trying to stop him. He can't hurt those big boxes. They're invoiced as common earth.
Ah, he's there, there, down in the hole. I know the secret now. The sea will save me from him. It's all that's left. It's all that's left.
August 4th. I am all alone in my ship. And still the fog. I dare not go below. I dare not leave the helm. So here, all night, I've stayed. And in the dimness of the night, I saw it. I saw him. God forgive me, but the mate had right to jump overboard. It was better to die like a sailor in the blue water. But I am captain, and I must not leave my ship. I have tied my hands to the wheel, and when my strength begins to fail, along with them I shall tie that which it dare not touch, my crucifix. I am growing weaker, and the night's coming on. God and the Blessed Virgin help a poor ignorant soul trying to do his duty.
Telegram, Seward, Perfleet to Van Helsing, Amsterdam. Lucy Westenra in alarming condition. Cannot diagnose. Come at once, Seward.
Telegram, Van Helsing, Amsterdam to Seward, Perfleet. I'm on my way to you. Please arrange for me to examine your patient immediately on my arrival, Van Helsing.
Ladies and gentlemen, I shall now explain that 6 months before the events recorded here, I'd become engaged to a young lady, Lucy Westenra. We were to be married in the spring. My old teacher, Professor Van Helsing, arrived at 4 the next afternoon. I took him at once to Lucy's house. She lay in her bed asleep. She was ghastly, chalky pale. The red had seemed to have gone even from her lips and gums, and the bones of her face stood out.
Young miss is bad, very bad. She must have blood or she will die. She is not anemic. The qualitative analysis of her blood is quite normal condition. It is strange. I do not like to think how strange. Look! My God! Her throat! Look!
The black velvet band that she always wore dragged up a little and showed a red mark on her throat. Just over the external jugular vein were 2 punctures. Not large, but not wholesome-looking. The edges were white and worn-looking. Well? Well, what is it, Professor? What's wrong with her? Speak frankly. You can tell me the worst.
I wish I could, Seward. I wish I could. But I do not dare.
But won't you tell me anything?
I will tell you this. Your young lady is in a danger greater than death. You must believe me. If you leave her for one moment and harm befalls, you will not sleep easy thereafter.
September 8th, I sat up all night with Lucy.
Arthur, I'm afraid.
My dear, you can sleep tonight. I'm here watching you. Nothing can happen. And I promise, at any sign of bad dreams, if I see anything, I'll wake you at once.
You will? Will you really? Then I'll sleep.
I sat all night by her bedside. She did not wake once during the night, although the boughs or a bat or something slapped almost angrily against the window pane. September 11th, still quoting from my private journals. This time I received a message from Purfleet. It read, 10:20 p.m. St. John's Hospital. Serious complications. Case 891. Your immediate presence in London imperative. I had no choice. Sometime later, a paper was found among Lucy Westenra's belongings.
I write this and leave it to be seen so that no one may get into trouble from me. I went to bed as usual, taking care that the window was closed as Dr. Van Helsing had directed. About 2 a.m, I awakened. I went to the door and called out, Arthur! Arthur! There was no answer. Something's broken the window. I'm in the room, all alone. I dare not go out. The house seems to be empty, the air full of specks, floating, circling in the draft from the window. The light burns blue, dim. What am I to do? Something very sweet and very bitter is all around me, like I'm sinking into deep water. There's singing in my ears.
You shall be flesh of my flesh. Blood of my blood.
September 12th, late. Only resolution and habit can let me make an entry tonight. We found her sprawled on the floor, and there was a draft in the room from the broken window. The throat was bare, showing the two wounds, looking horribly white and mangled.
We are too late, my friend. We have failed. God's will be done.
She is dying?
Yes, she's dying. Stay beside her. It will make much difference, mark me, whether she dies conscious or in her sleep.
It was late in the afternoon before she opened her eyes.
Arthur, oh my love, I'm so glad you've come.
I took her hand and knelt beside her. Her breath came and went like a tired, peaceful child. And then the light from the setting sun fell on her face, and then, insensibly, a strange change came over her. Her eyes grew suddenly dull and hard. Her breathing was heavy. Her mouth opened and the pale gums drawn back made the teeth look large and sharp.
Arthur, ah, my love, I'm so glad you've come. Kiss me, bend down and kiss me.
Run for your life! Run for your living soul and for hers!
Lucy!
She's dead.
Poor girl. Lie in peace at last. The end.
Not so. It is only the beginning. Wait and see.
Extra special. Read all about it. Kensington Horror.
Westminster Gazette, September 25th. A Hampstead mystery. The Kensington Horror and the woman in black are vividly recalled to mind by a series of events that have taken place recently in the neighborhood of Hampstead. Several cases have occurred of young children straying from home or failing to return from playing on the heath. In all these cases, the children have given as their excuse that they have been with a beautiful lady who offered them chocolates. In each case, the child was found to be slightly torn or wounded in the throat. The wound seems such as might be made by a rat.
Extra,
or
read
a small
all about
dog.
It. Extra, extra, read all about it. Hampstead Horror. Read about the beautiful lady. Read about the beautiful lady. Extra, extra.
The Hampstead Horror. Another child injured by the beautiful lady. We have just received intelligence that another child missed last night was only discovered late in the morning. It has the same tiny wound in the throat. Well, Seward, what do you think of that? You mean to tell me, my friend, that you still have no suspicions as to what poor Lucy died of?
Nervous prostration following on great loss or waste of blood.
And how was that blood lost or wasted? You are a clever man, my friend, and a good doctor, but you do not believe that there are things that you cannot understand. You are wrong, Seward. Are you aware of all of the mysteries of life and death? Can you tell me why in the Pampas there are bats that come at night and open the veins of cattle and horses and suck dry those veins, hmm? and how on some islands of the Western Seas there are bats which hang on trees all day, and then, when the sailors sleep on deck because it is hot, sweep down on them, and then in the morning are found dead men, as white as Miss Lucy was.
I understand none of these things.
After tonight, Seward, if you dare to come with me, perhaps then you will understand.
September 29th, before dawn. Now it is done, and I would sooner die a thousand deaths than to live again what I did this night.
We will spend the night, you and I, here in this courtyard where Miss Lucy is buried. We enter the tomb.
And then?
We open the coffin. You shall yet be convinced.
Take care, Van Helsing.
To Miss Lucy is dead, is it not so? Then there can be no wrong to her. But if she is not dead...
With some difficulty, we found the Westerner tomb. I took up my place behind a yew tree on one side of the tomb, Van Helsing on the other. I was chilled and frightened. Suddenly I saw something moving between the two yew trees, a dim white figure which held something at its breast. The figure stopped. I could not see the face, for it was bent down over what I saw to be a fair-haired child. There was a sharp little cry, such as a child gives in sleep, or a dog as it lies before the fire and dreams. Then the thing saw us. She drew back with an angry snarl. Her lovely blood-stained mouth grew to an open square. If ever a face meant death, I saw it at that moment. Then suddenly she turned and vanished in the direction of the tomb.
The child is unharmed. We leave him here in a safe place where the police find him. There's more to do. Come!
Now we're in the tomb. There in the coffin the thing lay, like a nightmare of Lucy. The pointed teeth, the blood-stained mouth. Van Helsing never looked up. From his bag he took out a book, his operating knife, a hammer, and a round wooden stake, 2 or 3 inches thick. Sharpened to a fine point and hardened over a fire.
Seward, the life of this unhappy woman has just begun. Then she becomes what you call undead. There comes after with a change, the curse of immortality. She cannot die, but she must go on age after age, adding new victims, because all that die from the preying of the undead become themselves undead and prey on others. So the circle goes on, ever widening, as of the ripples from a stone thrown into the water. But if this lady, this undead, be made to rest as true dead, then the soul of this poor lady whom we love should be again free.
Tell me, what am I to do?
Take this stake in your left hand, the hammer in your right.
Yes.
Place the point over the heart.
Here?
Then, when I begin the prayer for the dead, in God's name, strike.
Ugh.
Are you ready? Now, Domine Deus Apriste!
On the morning of July 11th, a man was found on the border of Transylvania. He talked wildly of wolves and boxes of earth and blood. He gave his name as Jonathan Harker. In a hospital at Klausenburg, he improved sufficiently to make possible his removal to England. I'm still quoting from my own personal papers. But then his condition remained so serious that he was committed for observation to a private ward in my hospital at Purfleet. Here he did so well that in 3 weeks he was completely recovered. It was during this time that his wife, Mina Harker, brought to the attention of Dr. Van Helsing and myself the journal that her husband had kept while the prisoner in the castle of a certain Count Dracula in Transylvania. I have before me the record of a meeting that took place in my study in Purfleet, transcribed by Mina Harker.
October 1st, meeting again, 10 after 8, Jonathan next to me, Dr. Seward afterwards, and Dr. Van Helsing at the head of the table.
My friends, there are such things as vampires. Had I known at first what now I know, one so precious a life would have been spared for the many of us who love her. The vampire which is among us is himself so strong that he can direct all of the elements, the storm, the fog, the thunder. He can command all the meaner things, the moth and bat, the owl, the fox, and the wolf. How, then, are we to begin our stride to destroy him? How shall we find his place? And, having found it, how can we destroy? My friends, it is a terrible task that we undertake. To fail here is not mere life or death. If we fail, we become as him, foul things of the night, as him. What do you say?
I answer for myself.
Come near.
I'm with you.
The professor laid a small golden crucifix on the table. We took hands and our solemn pact was made.
My friends, we too are not without strength. The vampire flourishes on the blood of the living. Without this, he cannot live. He throws no shadow. He makes no reflection in a mirror. He can transform himself into a wolf, to a bat. He can come on moonlight rays as elemental dust. He can see in the dark. He can do all of these things. Yet he is not free. His power ceases at the coming of the day. Then, until night, he must remain in the shape in which he finds himself, and except in his coffin home, in those earth boxes, he cannot rest. When we can confine him in his coffin, then, my friends, if we obey what we know, we will destroy him.
At that moment, something slapped wildly against the window. Then, at that moment...
Did you hit it?
I don't know.
We looked out of the window against the black sky. You could see nothing.
Data are now positioned. From the Count's castle in Transylvania to Whitby came 50 boxes of earth. All of these, to our certain knowledge, were delivered at Carfax. Recently, 12 of those boxes have been removed. First step, ascertain whether all of the rest remain in the deserted house next door or whether any more have been removed. We must break each of these boxes and sterilize the earth with holy water so he can no longer seek safety in it. And we must hurry!
The events of the next few days are described in Jonathan Harker's journal.
October 2nd, 5 a.m. Just returned from the empty house. Left Mina here at home. Well, we've done our work at Carfax. The place was filthy, yes, stagnant and foul, and alive with rats. We counted the boxes. Only 38 of them. And over each one, the professor went through the same mysterious work. It was dawn when we got back. I found Mina asleep. She looks paler than usual.
October 2nd, soon after they left, I fell asleep. I remember hearing the sound of barking dogs, and then it was silent. I got up and looked out of the window. There was a thin streak of white mist moving across the grass along the wall of the house. It dawned on me that the air in the room was heavy and dank and cold. The gaslight came only like a tiny red spark in the fog. I could see through my eyelids. The mist grew thicker and thicker. Then as I looked, the spark divided and seemed to shine on me through the fog like two red eyes.
You shall be flesh of my flesh, blood of my blood, blood of my blood.
October 2nd, 8 p.m. We are on the track. 12 boxes are delivered to an empty house at 337 Piccadilly.
My dear friends, until the sun sets tonight, Dracula must retain whatever form he now has. We have this day to hunt out all of his lairs and sterilize them. Then he will have no place he can move and hide. But we have only until sunset.
The house in Piccadilly was empty. Like the one at Purfleet, the same sickening smell is in the air. On the table we found a clothes brush, a hairbrush, and a comb and a basin. The latter containing dirty water, which was reddened as if with blood.
The boxes are back here. 8, 9, 10, 11.
Only 11.
There's a 12th box somewhere.
Gentlemen, it is after 6. The sun is setting. We've no time to lose. He will return at any moment. Open the boxes.
Quiet.
Listen. Here it is. It is he!
The window!
You waste your bullets, gentlemen. You think you baffle me? You with your pale faces all in a row like sheep in a butcher's. You think you have left me without a place to rest. But I have more, and time is on my side. The one you love is mine already. I have known her. Already my mark is on her throat. Flesh of my flesh, blood of my blood. She is with me always, over land or sea.
October 4th, morning. Another meeting in the study at Purfleet.
We must find that last remaining box, gentlemen. We must find it. As long as that earth exists and pure, as long as there remains one place of refuge for Dracula, there is no safety and no peace for any soul in England.
And for the undead, never peace so long as he lives. Blood of my blood. Blood of my blood.
Nina!
How do you know that?
Quiet, quiet.
With me always, over land and sea.
Nina, darling, how did you know that Dracula said those words?
I don't know. The words just came. Strange. There are times when somehow I feel that I am with him.
At sunset?
Yes, just as the sun sets. And then again at sunrise. Dr. Van Helsing, if at those times you...
Have you the courage?
The courage for what? What do you mean?
Dr. Van Helsing here will question me.
I will question her, yes. In a state of hypnosis. The one you love is already mine, he said. She is with me always, over land or sea. Ha, Count Dracula. Perhaps she will betray you if she is really with you, this one we love. Who knows if she's really with you over land or sea?
Blood of my blood.
Nina.
Yes?
Answer me, Nina. Are you with him?
Yes, I am.
Where are you?
I do not know. It is all dark.
What do you hear?
The lapping of water. I can hear it on the outside.
Then you are on a ship?
Yes.
What else do you hear?
There is the creaking of an anchor chain.
What are you doing?
Still. Oh, still. It's like death. It's like death.
Here is a report from Matson Peabody. Shipbrokers. Dated October 5th. According to Lloyd's list, the only sailing ship that left the Black Sea yesterday was the Tsarina Katrina bound for Varna. Somehow, before she sailed, a man came alongside, all in black, driving a cart with a great box in it. This he lifted down single-handed and carried below. No one remembers having seen him after that. A heavy mist came up over Doolittle Dock until sailing time. The rest of London Harbor remained completely clear.
Our plans are made. The average sailing time from London to the Black Sea is 3 weeks. We can travel overland to the same place in 3 days. We shall be there waiting for him when he arrives.
October 15th. Arrive Varna about 5 o'clock. Nina feels stronger. Every morning before sunrise and just before sunset, she speaks to Van Helsing in a trance.
Are you with him, Nina? Tell me. Are you with him?
I am with him.
What can you see?
Nothing. All is dark.
What can you hear?
I can hear the waves lapping against the ship. The water is rushing by. The wind is high. I can hear it in the shrouds and the seafoam.
So the Tsarina Katrina is still at sea, hastily to Varna. The Count cannot cross running water, so he cannot leave the ship without being observed.
What do you hear, Mina?
Lapping waves and rushing waters. Darkness. Darkness.
A whole week of waiting. Did telegram from Lloyd's.
Not yet reported.
Creeping mist. Darkness. Darkness and wind. Wind.
October 24th. Telegram. Lloyd's, London to Harker. Tsarina Katrina reported this morning from Dardanelles.
Lloyd's, London to Harker, October 28th. Tsarina Katrina in heavy fog, reported entering Galatz Harbor at 1 o'clock today.
Galatz. Galatz is 38 hours from here, and the first train for Galatz leaves at 6:30 tomorrow morning. My friends, we have lost.
I am with you. I can see nothing. Nothing. I can hear men's voices calling in the roar and the roar of the wind. I can feel the air blowing.
October 29th, evening. We are due between 2 and 3 in the morning, but already at Bucharest, we are 3 hours late.
What's going on? I feel something pass me like a cold wind. I can hear far off confused sounds as of men talking in strange tongues, fierce falling waters and the howling of wolves. There's another sound. How queer a sound,
like what? Speak, Mina, speak. I command you. I command you to speak.
Arrived in Galatz. Saw the captain of the Tsarina Katrina. We received a box for a party by the name of Dracula. October 29th. October 30th evening.
There are two ways in which Dracula can get back to his own place, by land or by water.
We've examined the map and found the most likely river is the Sereth.
You and I, Seward, will charter a steam launch and follow him up the river. Van Helsing and Mina will take a train to Aresti, and from there...
And from there we shall go in the track where Harker went to Bistritza over to Borgo. If you have not caught him before, we shall be meeting Dracula there.
October 31st. We arrived at Veresti at noon. Dr. Van Helsing and I brought the carriage here. We start in an hour. Our enemy is still on the river.
October 31st. We can earn good speed up the river at night. There's plenty of water and a bank for far apart.
November 1st. Evening, no news all day. We hear that a big boat went up the river before us, going at more than usual speed.
November 4th. All day driving. The country gets wilder as we go. By morning, we should reach the Borgo Pass.
November the 4th. Evening. We have left the launch. We've got horses who can follow along the track on the river. We are armed.
Look, quick! There they are now, heading west.
Through the dawn, we can see the Slovaks some miles before us, dashing along the river with a wagon. On it is a great box.
Late in the afternoon, we leave the Borgo Pass.
Van Helsing, look!
We could see a long way all around, far off beyond the white waste of snow, like a black ribbon curling between us and the river. Not far off came a group of men, mounted Slovaks, riding along. In the midst of them was a wagon that swept from side to side. On the wagon was a great box.
Look!
We see two horses following fast, coming up from the south. It's Seward and Harker. The Slovaks with the heavy wagons are losing their ground. Now they must not be more than a mile behind. Now the wagon is quite closer. We can see the great box lying gravely. Now they are almost upon us. Now has happened a strange thing. The wagon smashed into a great rock buried in the snow, lost its front wheel, turned over onto its side, jammed against the stone. The horses tore loose from their traces and bolted, and the Slovaks scattered and vanished after them. Then silence, silence like comes after ringing a bell.
Look, his face!
It is Dracula, sprawled out stiff and twisted in the smear of his own holy earth. The box, in falling, has emptied the dirt onto the snow. His face is old-looking. The skin is like paper. Dr. Seward, there is no time. Look at the sun.
It's sunset.
In 1 minute, it is sunset, and he is forever lost to us. Have you the stake of wood and the hammer?
Yes.
Now, Seward, pray for us. Kneel down and pray. Harker, the stake of wood over his heart. Be not afraid, Harker. Do not look into his eyes. The hammer. Now, Harker, strike. Strike.
Flesh of my flesh, guilt of my guilt, debt of my debt. Speak and be manifest in the instant of your master's peril. Element of darkness, rain, evil wind, mist and mold and tempest.
Strike!
The others couldn't, but somehow I can hear him speaking behind his eyes.
Claw, ring, tooth, scale. Tissue of flesh, death of my death, dead and undead, the hand of the living is over your master. Console me, my children. This instant is no longer than the space between two heartbeats, but the night is not here, and I am lonely. Come to your master, my children. Beguile him now in the instant of his peril. Beguile him with the sound of your names. Claw, ring, tooth, scale, tissue of flesh, claw, wing, tooth, scale, tissue of flesh.
Strike, Harker, strike!
There is one very dear to me who has not answered. My love, Mina, there is less than a minute between me and the night. You must speak for me. You must speak with my heart.
Give them to me! Jonathan, give them to me! Give me the stick of wood and the hammer!
Harker!
I shall never forget that moment. The look on poor Mina's face as she stood there. The angry star standing out on her throat. Her eyes like living coals in the last red of the sunset. She had torn the stake and the hammer out of my hands with the strength of an animal.
Mina, do you know what you have done, woman? Do you know what you have done to us? You have released him. The evil is free.
The sun.
As we looked down at Dracula, the eyes saw the sinking sun, and the hate in them turned to triumph.
Flesh of my flesh, come to me, my love. Come into the night and the darkness. You have served me well, my love. my bride, my...
Ladies and gentlemen, all the evidence is now before you. I've added nothing, and to the best of my knowledge, I have omitted nothing that might help to throw light upon the extraordinary events of the year 1891, which culminated on that terrible evening in the Borgo Pass. There remains only this one last report.
When Mina Harker seized the stake and hammer from her husband, I believe she was under some form of hypnosis. She herself remembers nothing, but whatever influence was at work on her, she must, at the last moment, have rejected it. For at the exact instant the sun disappeared, it was Mina Harker who drove the stake through the heart of the thing that called itself Dracula. At that same instant, even as we looked, the wound on the side of her throat was no more. As for Dracula, before the screams of the creature had died from our ears, the whole body crumbled into dust and passed from our sight. In the final moment of the solution, there was in the face a look of peace, such as I could never have imagined might have rested there.
Tonight's production of Dracula, adapted by Orson Welles, was the first of several OTARP broadcasts in which this brilliant group will bring to life a series of great narratives, all presented in the immediacy of the first-person singular. It's all right, you can rest easily. That's just a sound effect. There, over there in the shadows, see? Nothing. Nothing at all. Nothing at all. I think it's nothing, but remember...
Ladies and gentlemen, there are wolves. There are vampires.
Such things do exist. This is the OTARP Radio Network.
The Weird Circle was a syndicated series that was heard on the Mutual stations November 1943 through October 1947 and very briefly in September-October of 1947 on ABC. The Weird Circle presented 30-minute tales of horror, frequently inspired by classic horror ghost stories, frequently done by French authors.
In this cave by the restless sea, we are met to call out from the past stories strange and weird. Bellkeeper, toll the bell so all may know that we are gathered again in the Weird Circle.
Listen to the waves. Listen to the bell. Listen to the Weird Circle. Out of the past, phantoms of a world gone by, speak again the immortal tale, Frankenstein.
The wind howling outside my lonely home is my only companion. All else is quiet here as I sit by my window in the parlor writing this document for the scientific world. Be warned, you doctors and scientists who come after me. Be warned that man must not experiment with the secrets of life. My experiences started in the University of Manchester, where I was studying natural history. It was after class, May 22nd, 1818, that Professor Waldman, my close dear friend Henry Clavell, and myself were in the laboratory of the university.
Victor Frankenstein, your persistence amazes me. Someday I shall sit at your feet and allow you to teach me.
Thank you, Professor Waldman, but the whole subject of the structure of man has always been too clouded in mysticism.
Well, frankly, Victor, I prefer mysticism.
That's because you're a mystic, Henry.
Why, Henry's no more a mystic than I am. He just loves to avoid arduous work.
Oh, and translating that means I'm lazy, eh, Professor?
Well, if you prefer to put it that way. I rather think of you as a student whose nervous structure does not take kindly to natural history.
The professor's kinder to you than you are to yourself, Henry.
Well, if I worked as hard as you do, Victor, I should probably wear that same gaunt, sleepless look that you carry about.
Well, my experiment will be finished tonight, and then I'll manage the 8 hours of sleep that other men manage.
The secret experiment that will be finished tonight, huh?
Well, then, will you tell us just exactly what you're doing in the basement at home?
I'll tell the entire world. As a matter of fact, I stayed after class tonight, Professor Waldman, to ask you to join me this evening in the basement of our place to watch the completion of my work.
Well, what about me?
I don't think I dare invite more than one, Henry. And the professor's more interested in this type of procedure than you are.
I shall be delighted, Victor.
Just the best friend who never knows what's going on in his own home, that's all.
It's not that, Henry. But I thought you'd entertain Elizabeth for me while the professor and I were at work.
Entertaining Elizabeth will be a delightful favor, old boy. You know, I think you trust me too much with her.
Have you ever met Victor's fiancée, Professor Waldman? She's one of the most charming,
yes,
beautiful women.
Elizabeth was one of the most charming, beautiful women I'd ever known. I had been in love with her from childhood, but even my love for Elizabeth couldn't dim my passionate zeal for the work I was doing. It was 8 o'clock that evening. Henry, Elizabeth, and I were seated in the parlor. Elizabeth was saying that...
I'll be so glad, Victor, darling, when all this is over, if only you knew how tired you look.
The minute my work is done, successfully or unsuccessfully, I promise, Elizabeth, we'll be married and off to Switzerland before Henry has time to lock up the place.
But first, we must find out about the secret in the basement.
Henry's being eaten up by curiosity.
I don't blame him. I'm suffering pangs of what's this all about, too.
Well, you'll both know soon. I wonder where Professor Waldman is. He's late.
He'll be here soon, Victor. Stop pacing the floor, sweetheart.
I think I'll start my work downstairs. Send the professor down when he arrives, will you, darling?
We'll come down ourselves and take a look around. Or will we turn into a pillar of salt for peeking?
Nobody ever turned into a pillar of salt for peeking, Beth. It was for looking back.
Oh, nothing like a good practical working knowledge of the Bible for scientific experiments. Starts the night off right.
Yes, I thought jokingly of that paragraph from the Bible then, and she was turned into a pillar of salt. But what about a man who looks back? There is no ready reference for him or for me. I went downstairs to my laboratory at a little past 8, opened the door and started to tinker around to pass the time more quickly. My every sense was alive, taut, waiting of the sense of what was to come. I heard a knock on the side door which led me from my laboratory directly to the forest, which bordered Manchester. I looked out and...
Good evening, Victor.
Ah, did Elizabeth tell you to come down this way, Professor?
No, I found the entrance to your laboratory quite by myself.
May I help you with your coat, sir?
No. You proceed with your work. Nothing like trivialities to annoy a scientist at work. Ah, there we are.
Follow me, Professor, in the back room, and you'll see for yourself what this is all about.
Well, I feel that I'm in for a most exhilarating evening. I wish I had more students fashioned in your mold, Victor.
Well, Professor, here is my greatest...
Why, what's this? A full-size replica of a man?
Yes, only he isn't full-sized. He's fashioned on a grander scale. I should say this creature, standing up, would be approximately 8 feet 2 inches tall.
Well, you should have been an artist, Victor. He's a perfect reproduction. What did you make him out of? Wood? Clay?
Animal flesh.
Flesh?
Feel him.
Oh, he feels like the body of a dead man.
Or the body of a man who hasn't as yet been brought to life. This body is complete in every detail. Heart, lungs, teeth, even the fine nervous system.
Oh, interesting. Yes, interesting. How about the brain cells?
Yes, adult brain cells. I think he's quite handsome, don't you?
Well, each man to his own taste. He's the best reproduction of a man I've ever seen, but actually, his face is hideous. As a plastic surgeon, my dear Victor, I can't give you much credit. What do you intend to do with this hulk?
You see this fluid here in this test tube?
Yes.
I fill the hypodermic needle with it. And now, I'm going to inject the full 8 ounces into the vein, directly above his heart.
But why?
Why? Watch. You see, Professor, quite by accident I stumbled on the secret of life. I've been bringing small, one-celled creatures to life for quite some time.
The secret of life?
Within 30 seconds after this injection, this creature will live.
You're trying to play God, Victor. It's heresy.
It's science. I'm making a new race, by far finer than the present one. Larger in structure, stronger, heavier, healthier. A race able to live on nuts and berries, with greater capacity for feeling.
Victor, for the love of heaven, don't go through with this experiment. No man living has the right to tamper with the secret of life. You've created a monster on that floor. You've no idea what will happen if you go through with this.
Watch, Professor, the injection.
I only hope and pray this is a failure.
It can't be. His eyes moved. Watch him, Professor. He's like a baby, first realizing life. His hands touch the floor. His eyes are trying to focus on the world around him.
He's hideous!
Yes, he is hideous. I made the skin too much like parchment, I'm afraid.
Victor, get rid of that monster!
He's trying to stand up.
If that mind which you created is a twisted one, have you any idea what kind of horror you've let loose in England? As a humanitarian, I feel it's my Christian duty to do this now!
Put that knife down, Professor!
No! I can't let... Oh! He's got me in the clutch of his hands. Command him to stop this, Victor.
Stop fighting him, Professor. He's frightened. He has the same reactions as a child who grabs and won't let loose.
Let me go, monster. Oh.
Stop. Oh. Don't go out that door. Oh. Put the professor down. Don't go out that door. The monster left my laboratory through the side entrance into the forest, carrying the incredibly mangled body of the professor with him. I rushed out of my laboratory after him, but the creature was faster than I, and he disappeared from view. I returned to my laboratory and destroyed all evidence of the creature's manufacture. I burned the blueprints from which I had made his body. Then I carefully locked up my laboratory and went upstairs to join Henry Clavel and Elizabeth. I must have looked wild-eyed as I entered the room.
Henry, that's most amusing. You tell the best anecdotes in all of England.
You flatter me, Elizabeth.
Victor, you're through sooner than we expected. Darling, what's the matter?
Didn't the professor show up?
Nothing's the matter. My experiment was a failure.
Oh?
But the professor...
He never showed up. Beth, Henry, I want to go away.
Of course, darling. We will as soon as Henry can get the house locked up. We'll...
I don't want to wait. I want to leave at once. Tonight. Please, tonight, Beth. We can get married before we cross the channel and then go to Switzerland.
But it's almost midnight now, darling.
What's the difference? Please, Beth, if you love me...
But why tonight, Victor?
Henry, you've no idea what I've been through. I have to get away at once.
If you insist, darling, anything you want.
And we'll be married before daylight. Darling... Darling, Beth, I know a minister whom we can awaken. And so, Beth and I were married that evening in a little chapel on the coast. Then the three of us fled to Bern, Switzerland. I refused to have anything to do with the civilized world. No newspapers, no word of home, just the peace and quiet of the Swiss mountains. Henry and Elizabeth both tried to learn of the events that occurred in my laboratory that evening, but I never broke my silence on that subject. After the first tries, they refrained from asking me about it again. It was in the middle of the fourth month of our visit when Henry and I were sitting on the terrace of the little house in the mountains. Beth was out picking berries when Henry suddenly...
Victor, I'm your closest friend. I tried to keep silent about it. Well, Victor, the day after we left England, I bought a newspaper.
Did you, Henry?
Yes. I saw this clipping on the front page. I couldn't very well miss it.
What clipping?
This one. The horribly mangled remains of Professor Waldman was found on Beckman Hill. The identity of the unknown murderer is being sought by Scotland Yard.
Poor Professor Waldman, I had no idea.
Hadn't you?
No. What are you trying to say to me, Henry?
You're leaving England so suddenly that very night. Your fear of being discovered. The secret experiment. Well, it all seemed to add up to some kind of strange connection with this clipping. Now, if you're in trouble, Victor, you can depend on me. I'll stay by your side.
I'm not in trouble. I'm just tired. Terribly tired.
And you know nothing of the professor?
Absolutely nothing.
He didn't come to our chateau that evening?
I told you he didn't then. Stop questioning me!
Victor! Victor!
We're out here, Beth.
Oh, I just had the most horrible experience. Oh, darling, I'm so glad to see you.
You look pale, Beth. Sit down right next to me.
What happened, Beth?
I was walking in the woods not far from here. I looked up and I saw a man, sort of a man, standing over me.
Men aren't so bad, that is, if you happen to know the right ones, and you do.
I'm not joking, Henry. He wasn't exactly a man. He was twice the height of anyone I've ever seen, and his skin looked like dried parchment. It's incredible, but I think I've seen a monster.
Monster?
Yes, I ran away, and he didn't follow me. He just stared after me, watching me. You do believe me, don't you?
A monster stared after you?
Look, look, Henry, Victor, through the trees, right out there. Look, there he is again!
Yes, the monster stood there, silhouetted against the trees. The monster which I had created, standing like an evil blot of flesh and bone, moved in the darkening twilight, and then suddenly, phantom-like, disappeared. Beth watched as I darted from the piazza after the disappearing creature in the backwoods. As I grew near to the heavily wooded section, giant footprints in the soft mud about me showed the path ahead. The sun was sinking in the west, and the last orange pinpoints of light needled my flesh until every sense within me was tingling with the expectation of seeing my living horror. Then I realized I was unarmed. Every crooked tree, each twisted branch which obstructed my path appeared to be his form. I heard the crackling of a branch and the moving of a form on the velvet moss.
I thought you'd come, Creator.
You!
Are you frightened, Creator?
You dare talk to me?
Please don't turn away from me. Please.
Let me go.
I mean no harm to you, Victor Frankenstein. You must listen to me. You created me. You owe me that much.
I owe you nothing, murderer.
Why am I a murderer? Because you created a form so horrible, a face so distorted, that no man can look upon me and call me friend. I'm an outcast. You can save me.
Let me go.
Not until you hear my story. Sit down, Creator.
My arm, let me go.
I wandered through the streets of London that first day. Children screamed in the streets. People fought together, trying to kill me. And I was lonely and hungry.
How did you follow me here?
Not long ago, I returned to my birthplace. the laboratory. I broke in and discovered your identity. First I fled to Scotland and lived outside of a cottage. That's how I learned to speak. An old blind man was teaching a young French girl to speak English. I listened to the lessons from the open windows.
Now what do you expect of me?
A companion. A woman of the same species as mine with my defects. One who will be my friend. His being you must create.
No, I'll not do it.
You must! Every man's entitled to a wife.
No!
You must! If you create her for me, I'll take her with me into the far ways. And no one will see either of us again. Ever.
How will you live?
On roots and berries. We'll manage together. Please, you cannot deny me this.
A mate? A monster's mate?
You will. You will. I swear I'll never harm another human. Never, creator. If you'll only grant me just one companion.
And if I refuse?
If you refuse, even a brain that you have made, creator, might become twisted and distorted.
And so, that night in the forest, I made a devil's bargain. I bargained to create a monster's mate, perhaps another murderer. How could I know? The monster swore to live in the forest and wait a year or 2 years if necessary, and upon completion of my work, he would take his companion away. But if I broke my promise, he swore revenge. And so I started work. I searched Paris for the necessary equipment, built a shack in the woods about a mile away from our chalet. 3 months I worked, 3 solid months, shaping her who was to be his mate. And then one night it was windy outside. I thought the wind had blown the door open when...
Victor! I'm sorry, I had to disturb you.
Is it Beth?
No, not Beth. She's fine, and since her love, it's the townspeople. Your activities have stirred up a lot of curiosity.
Oh, the fools.
Well, I can't blame them, especially after the rumors which have been going around. Rumors that... Victor, you know of the monster of these forests. You've known him all along. People have seen him and connect him with you. Mothers in the village are frightened for their children.
I know nothing.
Look, I'm only trying to help you.
I know nothing, I tell you.
But the men have banded together. They're going to make a raid on you here, to burn your laboratory down, to find the monster who lives in these woods.
They can't. They mustn't.
What devil's work are you carrying on, man? I'm trying to help you. Oh, Victor, won't you please let your friends be your friends?
Henry, will you go back to Beth and leave me alone?
Beth is safe at home. You're in danger, and I won't leave your side this night, my friend.
Then be prepared.
Prepared for what?
You've guessed many of the reasons for my secrecy.
Then there is a monster.
At school, I stumbled on the secret of life. I was trying to create a superior race. I was a fool, and I created him instead.
Then he does live.
Yes, he lives.
Professor Waldman, what happened to Professor Waldman?
The night I created the monster, Waldman became frightened. He screamed, attempted to kill the creature. The creature, like a child, warded him off and then tore him to pieces in front of me. I couldn't stop him. The monster had killed before it had really begun to live.
Then what?
The monster left the basement through the side entrance, carrying the professor's corpse. I had no choice. I had to leave the country.
Then what are you doing with that creature now?
I'm fulfilling a promise. Follow me into my cabin and I'll show you. How soon do you think the townsfolk will be here?
Within 2 hours or so. They're meeting in the square in town.
Come in.
What? A woman?
Yes, a woman. The monster's mate, his friend. I promised him a friend, and in return he promises to hide himself forever from the world.
A devil's bargain, Victor.
A bargain I must keep for all our sakes.
But the monster proved himself a murderer time and time again. Why in London, after the death of Professor Waldman?
Time and time again.
But how do you know the mate won't be even more vicious than he? You'll let loose an avalanche of hatred. Oh, destroy her before you bring her to life.
Yes, avalanche of hatred.
Look, you've no time to waste. Set fire to this cabin, quickly, Victor. Set fire to the cabin and come away. But man alive, you cannot go through with this thing.
But the promise.
It's a promise to a fiend. He'll be your death and ours, Victor. Oh, hurry, man. Hurry if you've any love for Beth.
I've been insane with grief and fear for Beth and you. Go back to Beth, Henry, at once and wait for me.
And you?
I'll set fire to the cabin as soon as I destroy my books. I'll join you later.
Well, hurry, friend. We'll meet you home as soon as you can make it.
For one full hour, I worked feverishly. I soaked the shack in oil. Then, taking a taper from the vase, I lit the fire. The fire started quickly. I placed my books in the very center of the room and then opened the door of my shack. The experiment was at an end, and I felt free. The monster's mate would never live. I walked out, and then I saw him. his face contorted with rage.
My wife! My only chance to have a friend! My only chance!
I knew then what was in his mind as he raced through the forest in front of me. The blazing shack was a beacon of light. I saw his huge, misshapen form outdistance me. He was faster than I, taller than I, and covered more territory. Racing, running blindly through the forest, I reached my home. The door was flung open. Henry, mutilated and torn, stumbled blindly toward me.
Victor, the monster!
Henry, what?
I tried, Victor. I tried.
Henry, you...
Beth, alone with...
Beth?
Upstairs!
Beth, I'm coming, darling, I'm coming upstairs!
Henry! Victor! Henry! Somebody help me!
I'm coming, darling, I'm coming! If you kill her, I'll...
Beth, oh, my darling, oh, Beth, no! Both you and Henry, both dead.
You two all alone. Creator!
Yes, both of them were dead. All my dear ones gone from me now, and I'm alone. The wind howling outside my window is my only companion. All else is quiet here as I sit by my window writing this document. I am dying of loneliness and fear. Shunned by the world, hated by everyone, I know I am waiting for the monster's return. And he, having eluded the world, will return when I've suffered my full share of misery as he has suffered his.
From the time-worn pages of the past, we have brought you this story, Frankenstein. Bellkeeper, toll the bell.
These recreations of Dracula and Frankenstein have been a production of the On the Air Radio Players, sponsored by the Henrico County Department of Recreation. The voices for tonight's show were Lauren Davis, Deborah Burek-May, Sean Hambright, Jonathan Liebel, Jim Scott, Art Trotter, Andy Wells, and Michael Wells. Our sound effects wizards were Bob Dudden, Dana Essigman, Lauren Davis. Music has been furnished by Steve Organ. This production has been directed by Cheryl Criswell. Script editing was done by Bob Dudden. Our production manager for tonight's show has been Carol Andrews. Tonight's sound recording engineers have been Devin Langston and Brett Zwerdling. Be sure to join us next year on March 2nd and 3rd as the studio audience here at Glen Allen Cultural Arts Center for our next production of A Philadelphia Story. Visit our website, www.otarp.com, to learn more about the on-the-air radio players. You'll find information on future shows, including audition and show dates. You can also download past productions, such as The Maltese Falcon, which was our last production. This is your announcer, Art Trotter, speaking. Good night, and happy listening.